Chaplain Schumacher, you served as a chaplain for 31 years, is that right?
Actually, I had 33 years commissioned service, 30 years active duty.
Okay. That's quite a long time. Tell me about your call to ministry and why you chose chaplain ministry in the first place.
Yeah, it goes way back to when I was in high school. I was going to church. My brother and I and another guy had a brass trio. We were playing in the worship that morning. And when the pastor gave the invitation, we found that all three of us wanted to go forward and make that a statement that we wanted to commit our lives to Christ and commit our lives to whatever he had for us. And the pastor said something that was quite significant to me and still is with me when he looked at us and he said, "You three men have no idea of the potential you represent for ministry." Well, it just hit me hard and stayed with me. So I went on through college and got a degree in education and taught school. And I was a music pastor, youth pastor, school and sports pastor and a school teacher, and all this was going on, and I hardly had any time for myself. And so they said, "Well, we're having summer camp up in Tockwitz Pines, and this is in Southern California, and we want you to be a camp counselor for the boys." So I went up there, and Martha and I were newly married, and she took over a cabin for the girls, and I took over a cabin for the boys. And that night was very raucous. These guys were pretty much bent on trying to destroy the whole camp. And so I got up and left about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I went down and found the camp director. And I said, "You know, I'm not going back in that cabin." I said, "I refuse to subject myself to the things that are being done by these guys." He said, "Please go back, and we'll take care of it in the morning." So he got everybody together. He dressed the situation in very firm words. "You guys either get on board with the camp, any more problem, any more trouble, and you will be sent home. Do you understand me?" I thought, wow, praise the Lord for that. So later, I said to somebody, I said, "Boy, I don't know this guy, but I said, I really appreciate the firmness with which he spoke to these boys." And they said to me, "Well, he is a former military guy. What would you expect?" And I said, "Oh, former military. What'd he do?" "Well, he was a chaplain." Something happened when I heard the word chaplain that just stopped me dead in my tracks. And I knew it was significant, but I didn't know in what way it was significant. And so I saw him later, and I said, "Can I come and talk to you?" And he said, "Yeah, what about?" And I said, "Well, you were in the military." He said, "Yeah." I said, "You were a chaplain." "Yeah." It was very crisp, like, "What the heck do you want to know about me being a chaplain?" I found out later he was not terribly happy with the chaplaincy and got out because he didn't really like it. And I said, "Well, tell me something about what it means to be a chaplain." And he said, "Well, it's not for everybody, but," he said, "you have a lot of opportunity." And so as he talked, something inside of me began to say, "John, this is the path that I have for you." Didn't hear any voices. It was, "This is the path I have for you." At that moment, I knew God was calling me. And I thought, why? I mean, I am a school teacher, I'm a music pastor, I'm a youth pastor. Why are you calling me out of that to think about the military? And in some ways, it didn't make any sense. And that was confirmed to me later when I told the pastor of the church, "I think God is calling me into the chaplaincy." And the pastor said, "Well, I can understand the ministry, but I can't understand this chaplaincy thing." I said, "Well, the chaplaincy is where I'm headed." And I stayed on that next year in the church to test that call. I didn't immediately leave. I had been there 2 years, and I stayed an extra third year. I had already been signed a contract to stay there, and I thought, if this is real, it'll still be real a year from now. And sure enough, during that year, all I could think of was the opportunity. And I didn't know much about it. I didn't have anybody to talk to. Tell me what it's like to be a chaplain. Tell me what the opportunities are. What does it mean to you? What does it mean to your marriage? Or anything like that. I couldn't ask anybody anything. But I had this burning desire in my heart to do that. So much so that I discovered that I had to have graduate training. I had to have a seminary degree. Even to qualify to be a military chaplain. So we left California, went back to Indiana, went to school, where I was in seminary for 3 years to qualify me academically to be a military chaplain. And from the time that I really felt that call up in the mountains of Southern California until the day I went on active duty was 6 years. Never in that time did I doubt that God had that for me. Even though it was difficult, I knew that's where my heart was. But when it took me so long to get in, I began to wonder, Lord, did I misread your calling? And I would pray that. And right at a perfect time, God let me know that the door had opened, that I was going to be called on active duty. And it was right at a time when I was ready to leave the ministry that I was in and move to some other kind of ministry somewhere else. And there it was. It was as clear as anything could be. Telegram from the Department of Defense and the Pentagon, we have an opening for you. Please get your certification renewed, and we will bring you on active duty. And I don't think I ever lost that call. I don't think I've lost that sense of calling even till today. And
sir, so many chaplains who are serving as chaplains were pastors before. And so many chaplains leave the chaplain ministry and become pastors. So in many ways, chaplain ministry and pastoral ministry in a local church is very similar. But at the same time, the ministries are very unique and distinctly unique. Different from each other. Very Can you talk about some of what you think those differences are? What makes chaplain ministry distinct from pastoral ministry?
Well, a verse came to me that Paul wrote about himself. And as you know, Paul was not a pastor in the typical sense. He was a church planter. And Paul mixed with whoever he could mix with. And he said in 1 Corinthians 9:22, the second half of that verse, I have become all things to all men, but that by all means I might win some. And I think that a man has to have that sense of, I want to be a soldier because I know it's going to take a soldier to win over soldiers. And as much as I could know at that point, that was one of the driving forces. I wanted to be a soldier. I wanted to live with soldiers. I wanted to go where they went. I wanted to train with them. I wanted to be as good a soldier as there was in the unit. And I wanted then to develop an authenticity and a credibility that would allow them then to see who I was as a man of God, and that my message would have credibility because I lived their life for them and with them. And so when it came time to go off to combat, as I did in 1967 to Vietnam, I knew I was right where God wanted me. And it was living that life with those soldiers that allowed me to have, I think, a very rewarding and an effective ministry. So that to me was a huge difference, and I knew it was going to be different. I wasn't going to be in a denominational church. I wasn't going to be preaching the denominational line or the denominational package as such. I was going to be able to meet those guys where they were and try to take them where I felt God wanted them.
Which has its own distinct challenges in a pluralistic environment. We'll talk about that here in just a little bit.
Yeah.
But I wanted to jump right into your experience, your combat experience. Well, you came on active duty what year?
I came on active duty in 1965.
And then?
Within a year, I was deployed with my unit to Vietnam.
So you came on active duty in 1965.
Yes.
And just a question from a American historical perspective. What was the social climate like? I mean, the winds of when did the Vietnam War kicked off? What year?
It kicked off probably 3 or 4 years after or before I actually. I mean, it was just getting started in a little bit more of visibility and more troops going at the time they called up our unit. So the Vietnam, from the standpoint of having special forces and advisors in that country, had started about 3 or 4 years before that.
Okay, so when you went on active duty, did you have the expectation that you'd be going to Vietnam?
I didn't. It wasn't as pronounced an issue until after I went on active duty, and during that first year, it began to be more and more evident to me that Vietnam was going to be something very significant and very likely I could wind up there. Now, there was a colonel at my installation that I knew very well, and he had been in forever, and I said something to him about it. I said, do you think my unit could be called to Vietnam? And he said, well, you're in the type of unit that has no effectiveness on that kind of a battlefield, and no, you will never be called to Vietnam. And it wasn't long after that when the word got out, no, your whole unit is going to Vietnam, and you're going to be in field training for at least 3 months nonstop to prepare the unit to go and deploy. And so it was clear that the momentum was building toward a larger force and a more active force and a much bigger war.
It was in the environment at that time. Was there a lot of social opposition to the war? And had the military suffered the attacks from society at that point?
At that point, it had just started to build. Okay. And it started to build because of television and television reporters on the battlefield taking pictures of men being wounded. We had never had a war where people back home could see that. And so there was a lot of social unrest that started out on the West Coast and began to creep across the country. And so we knew we were going into a thankless effort to help our country.
And what kind of unit were you a part of?
It was an 11th Armored Cavalry unit. Now, the unit that I was in was the perfect place to start military ministry because we had everything. We had artillery. We had air assets. We had infantry assets. We had a little bit. We had tanks. We had personnel carriers. We had a little chunk of the entire army in that CAV unit, so we could do a lot of things. But because of the heavy part of it, and because of the type of terrain that we were going to in Vietnam, people said, well, you guys won't really have that much to do. Well, it turns out that we had an awful lot to do, and we lost an awful lot of people in the process.
What was it like leading up to that deployment? What were your soldiers, what was their general disposition? Were they naive to what they were heading into? Were they excited? Were they full of arrogance as they thought about going to war?
Well, it may be all of the above. I will say this, that most of them, including me, were very naive about what it was to go to war. And it wasn't until we really got in the mix that we really woke up and realized how dangerous war is, how sad it can be, how tragic it can be, how traumatic it can be. And that's when soldiers started talking to me about their fears, their uncertainties, and they woke up and realized where they were, and this was for real. And war is an ugly thing, and terrible things happen in war, and you almost have to experience it to be aware of that and to have that awareness of who you are and what you mean to the situation in which you find yourself.
I want to ask you about your first experience in combat. But before I do, before we talk about that, What was it like? I want you to tell me what it was like when you kissed Martha goodbye. And I mean, you know, it's different. And soldiers deploy so much now, but it was so different then. And the separation was so much more definite. You know, today we have so much technology. But what was that like saying goodbye?
What it was like saying goodbye is it was right up to the last day. I had to move her to another location because in those days they shipped out units to build up the force, but they didn't send the units back at the end of a year. They piecemealed us back so they could keep the flag there and still do the mission. And so new guys kept coming in all the time, and that's the way it was, individual rotation out of that unit coming back. And so I got on a train to go back to my base and went in to say goodbye to Martha and put my arms around her. And all I could feel was just kind of a limpness and a shaking because she was sobbing so hard. But she had held up very well until that moment. And when I hugged her and kissed her goodbye, she knew that she wasn't going to see me for a long time, if ever. And it hit her. I tried to stay strong for her. I didn't break down and cry, but I left with a very heavy heart. Obviously, it was very hard. And I had two little girls at that time, and I had to tell them goodbye, and they were young enough. They didn't know what was going on with Dad, and they didn't even know what it was going to be like to be without Dad. They couldn't process all of that. But even today, it hurts to go back and think about that first goodbye.
Deployment expectation was 12 months at that time?
It was 12 months, except that because they were rotating people out to make room for new people and that we wouldn't all leave the same time, they had what they call a drop. And you could get up to 30 days drop so that they could and generally get new people on board, not all at once, but generally in the process. I got a 15-day drop. We left around the 1st of August, I think I said September, but we left around the 1st of August. They dropped me down to the 15th of July, and I was able to be home for my daughter's birthday. So
a year.
Yeah, 11 and a half months was my first tour.
So no mid-tour.
There was, at that time, they started what they called R&R. R&R was 5 days. And R&R was a free trip to Hawaii, Malaysia, Thailand, or wherever you wanted to go. They had it all set up. And I, about halfway through, I started talking to Martha, would you like to meet me in Hawaii? I can get away from here. We could have at least 4 days together in Hawaii. And she said she thought that would be good. So we did get that time. But it was almost more painful than it was useful because you got there. You heaved a sigh of relief. You were with the one you loved. It was like a second honeymoon. And all of a sudden, you were back at the airport, at the Honolulu airport, where they were playing sweet Hawaiian love songs and all of this. And all the women were hanging on their men, and they were crying. And it was, and Martha held up pretty well. It wasn't until she got almost home that she said she really broke down. But yeah, that was an R&R. Now you can come back for whatever, a month or 2 weeks or whatever, and you could be with your family. Well, I didn't even get to see my girls because she came by herself to Hawaii so we could just have a couple of days together, and that's all it was. I'd been gone 6 months when I held her in my arms at the reception center in Honolulu, and that was a very exciting moment, except we had no sooner let go of each other than we knew in 3 days we were going to have to do it all over again.
So going back to when you first arrived in Vietnam, were you changing out with another chaplain? Or was your location, were you the only chaplain at that location? And what was the environment like when you first arrived in Vietnam?
Well, I deployed with a squadron, which is the same as a battalion, of a cav regiment, and so I was their chaplain. And there were other chaplains that deployed at the same time. So we were there in a makeshift campground that they started to put together just for us. And it was GP, medium tents, cots, mosquito nets, and that was our base camp. That's all we had. We didn't even have jungle fatigues at that point. We had the old fatigues that we had traveled with, and it wasn't until later that we even got jungle fatigues. But it was very sobering place to be, and it was probably good to start that way because we knew then we were becoming more aware that this was for real and that this was going to be a long time. And eventually we got sent to another area where we built our own base camp. And eventually that turned out to be a fairly decent place, although it was still cots and tents and all that stuff. But those initial things of getting to Vietnam was, it still hadn't really hit us. We hadn't had any missions yet. We hadn't gone on the first mission. We were there, we were lonely, guys were getting drunk, and that was kind of what it was all about. In fact, my first service was held in the enlisted men's beer tent. We swept it out, and we had a service in there.
Budweiser and the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
You remember what you preached on?
No, I have no idea. I hope it was good, and I hope it was, you know, as time went on and casualties began to amount, it really sharpened my focus as to the kind of messages I preached.
So talk about your first mission and the days leading up to that and everyone's mentality. And then you, as we say, you rolled outside the wire. Were you on foot? Were you mounted? Describe that whole first mission.
We had a mission that gradually came up. They gave us a couple of months to kind of get weathered in and get all the gear operating and all of the heavy armor that we had. And we were finally ready to go. And by that time, I had a tent where I could hold a service and I could sleep in the back of the tent, and that was my living arrangement. That morning that we were kicking off this operation, I got up, tried to go to the mess hall to get something to eat because we were leaving in a little while, and it was just surreal because my heart was clear up in my throat. I was scared to death. I saw the commander, and I said, it's really scary, this first mission. And he said, yep, chaplain. He said, this is what it's all about. And so I got in the vehicle, rode with my men out into the combat zone, and there was one guy that was especially a good friend of mine, and I kind of cozied up to him. He was a deputy commander of one of the squadrons, and we had a cup of coffee before it got dark and it was time to turn in, and there was no place for me to sleep, so I slept in the back of his vehicle, a personnel carrier. And in the middle of the night, I heard explosions. And we were attacked in the middle of the night. And I heard machine guns going off. I heard some explosions. And found out the next morning that they had come in and set up Claymore mines aimed at us in the perimeter that we had. And they were blowing those Claymore mines. One of them did not explode. Later that morning, I found out that had it exploded, it might have taken me out because it was aimed right toward where I was in that vehicle. And one of the really fascinating stories that night is that there was one guy who was the TC, the track commander, in his vehicle. He was wide awake. He had his thumb on the trigger of the machine gun. And when he looked out, he saw what he thought were kids.
Wow.
And he did not shoot. And that shows you the heart of the American soldier.
Wow.
He would take the hit rather than to shoot what he thought were young kids that were setting us all up. Whether it was young kids, I don't know. But I'll never forget, the next morning I went over and talked to him, and the whole side of his vehicle was pocked with shrapnel. and yet he had stood in his place and his thumb on a machine gun and would not fire.
Wow.
We lost one soldier in that operation, and that was the first soldier we lost in the 11th Armored Cav, and I had the first memorial service of the first casualty in our unit.
Was that outside the wire right there, or did you wait till you got
back?
That
was in
another
location where one of the units had formed their perimeter, and this young man went out to relieve himself in a tree line, never given it a second thought, and a sniper took him out.
Wow.
So that I had literally had the first service. Had a lot more before it was over, but that was the first one.
You'll never forget that mission.
Oh, no, I won't, because I never felt fear. I wasn't prepared for the fear I felt going on that first mission. After that, my system, my whole sense about who I was and who these guys were changed to the point that I did not have that fear on all the missions I went on. I knew I had to do it. I knew it was part of my ministry. Nobody told me I had to go on the missions. I just knew I had to be with these guys. And so I would find a commander and say, can I ride with you on this mission? Because they sort of had the mentality that you go with the medics. And I said, I don't want to go with the medics. I want to be out there where the troops are. And so that's the way I did my missions.
I'm sure they were glad to have the chaplain along.
Well, some
with
good
them.
Things happened on those missions where I could counsel with guys, and one in particular where this young man came up to me and said, I don't know the Lord. And I was able to lead him to the Lord, and his name is on the wall. He lost his life in an ambush about 15 days before he was to rotate back.
Wow.
At the end of the year.
During the deployment that he...
And his name was Larry Dawson. Larry was... a young man from Everett, Washington, and we just became very, very good friends. And you could see the change in him when he really committed his life to Christ. And then when I went to the wall in Washington, D.C., I found his name, and it was extremely difficult to see him and see the names of some of the other guys that were killed in the same ambush.
Yeah. What were some of the other significant events that happened to you after your first deployment?
It wasn't our first mission. It was, there were about four different armored cavalry squadrons from different units. It wasn't just the 11th, my unit. Went up north of Saigon, which was called the Iron Triangle. And it was called the Iron Triangle because anybody that tried to go in there was just wiped out. And so we were going to go in with the armor and try to put a stop to that by going through this one area and just cleaning house with anything that was left there. When we got up there, the charcoal fires and the hooches were still warm. They had gotten out ahead of us. And so in that mission, two things happened that I will never forget. One was one evening I was sitting with a guy who was, his name was Rogers, Sergeant Rogers. And Sergeant Rogers had helped me fix up my tent so that I could sleep in the end of it and we could make a chapel out of the other end of it. And he was just a carpenter. That's all he was trained for. And he came over and sat down beside me, and he said, sir, I need to talk to you. And I said, what is it? He said, they want me to be a tunnel rat in the morning. He said, sir, I'm not trained for that. He said, I am just scared to death. He said, I don't want to be. He was a small guy, so he was perfectly suited physically to be a tunnel rat. And I said, well, tell the first sergeant that you're not, you're not going down and that you're not trained for that. He said, I can't do that. I said, well, then I said, do it and we'll pray that everything works out fine. He went into that tunnel the next morning, and he hadn't gotten very far before the guys on the other side opened up, killed him. And they said, we've had some men killed in that tunnel. And I said, don't tell me. Sergeant Rogers was one of them. They said, yes, it was. So I had that experience. And the second one was when Sergeant First Class Montana was in his personnel carrier, and he, his vehicle crossed over a 500-pound bomb that had been buried in the road, and from somewhere it detonated and killed everybody on that vehicle. And his buddy, Huff, Sergeant First Class Huff, they called themselves PT Boat Commanders. They had been together. They trained together. They were the best of buddies. And Huff came over with tears in his eyes, and he said Montana was killed. And so I stayed there until they brought the bodies in and the body bags, and it was a very, it was a learning moment for me, because what do you do when your buddies are looking at body bags and grieving? You know, what kind of wonderful things can you come up with that will be comforting to these guys? And it hit me very forcefully, nothing. Your presence means more than your words. Just stand there. Put your armor on them. Do anything. But just stand there and be with them. And we talk about the ministry of presence in the military chaplaincy, but boy, that was a powerful moment when I said not a word. But I just stood there with those guys that were crying because their buddies had been killed. And I thought, that's a valuable lesson to learn. You don't always have to talk, but being there speaks very loudly and very eloquently. When there's nothing to say, but you are there with them, and they know it.